from powerlineblog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierenghoff, and Stephen Hayward.
Welcome to the Powerline Show. It's Steve Hayward sitting in the captain's chair today for John Hinderacher, who is away. Scott Johnson and Paul Mierenghoff are with me, and it is our honor today to have Michael Oren with us. Michael Oren is the immediate past ambassador of Israel to the United States, a historian, the author of many fine books, including a new one out in a few days that's getting tremendous publicity called Ally, My Journey Across the American-Israeli Divide. I'm going to throw straight away to Scott Johnson, who has read an advanced copy of the book and is prepared with questions. Scott, over to you.
Thanks, Steve. Ambassador Oren, let me say it up front. This is an essential book to understand the long, strange trip we've been on the past 6.5 years, and I am so excited to have you make time for us today to talk about it. You have such an unusual background. I wonder if you'd just briefly go into that with it a bit for our audience and some folks who may not know who you are.
All right. Scott, Stephen, Paul, thank you for hosting me this afternoon. Well, the book opens, the first 50 pages of a 400-page book is about my story before I arrived in Washington. I don't think you could understand my perspective in Washington without understanding a bit about how I got there. And how I got there was a very American story of a person who grew up in a small American town and played Little League football and Little League baseball and went to the junior proms, but always had this very deep sense of commitment to Israel, love of the Jewish people, and wanted to move to Israel, serve in its army, and eventually serve as Israel's ambassador to the United States. Because when I was 15 years old, I met Yitzhak Rabin, who at that time was acting as Israel's ambassador in Washington, and it so influenced me, shaking his hand. And that 50 pages tells a story of moving to Israel during a tough period, the 1970s, when Israel was like the Wild West, of serving in the army, fighting in several wars, raising a family out in the desert, and ultimately fulfilling my dream of becoming ambassador. And coming into that position, having prepared myself as an historian, as a writer, as someone who had appeared quite frequently in the American media, and coming to the job, on one hand, with a deep sense of commitment to the alliance between the two countries, but on the other hand, understanding that with the election in America of Barack Obama, the election of Israel of Benjamin Netanyahu, that this was going to be one of the, if not most challenging, chapter in the U.S.-Israel alliance.
As you suggest, Ally is part memoir, part autobiography, part history. If there's one theme you wanted readers to take from the book, what would it be?
Well, there's a scene. Well, there's a scene I very much that touched me very deeply is when the Israel's northern Carmel forest was on fire. And it was Israel's most destructive fire. Dozens of people were killed in a matter of hours. The fire was descending on Haifa. And I was going into the White House for a Hanukkah party. And I got a call from Prime Minister Netanyahu talking about the fire, saying that we had run out of the type of material you need to retard flames. We didn't have fire extinguishing planes to go directly to the president and ask for his assistance. I did that, and the president turned to his assistant, Reggie Love, and said, get Israel whatever it wants. And I spent the entire night in the White House in the Situation Room coordinating the assistance from the United States, which included scrubbing down the warehouses in Europe for this type of retardant and getting us those fire extinguishing planes. That night, President Obama flew off to Afghanistan. The first question he asked when he got on the ground was whether Israel had received his planes. That was a very illuminating event for me because understanding that, contrary to what many of his critics said, the president is not anti-Israel. He supports Israel. He does not think that Israelis understand their own interests better than he understands their interests. And he has this notion of a rather mythic pre-1967 Israel, which I'm not sure ever entirely existed. But it's important for me to keep that in perspective. We were dealing with an administration that had a very different worldview than ours, and not just from Netanyahu's worldview, an Israeli worldview. It's an administration that was deeply committed to the Palestinian issue, deeply committed to reconciling with Iran and reaching a nuclear agreement with Iran. And so in many pages, I set out the disagreements and the breakdown of trust. It's also important to keep in mind that when the chips were down, in the case of that fire, the United States was there for us. And there is this historic and deep-faceted, deeply seated alliance.
Ambassador Oren, your book is so rich with so many threads. I want to pick up one of the ones that you just mentioned, which is the threat of Iran. It kind of hangs over the book like a pall. And it seems to me, slightly contrary to what you just said, you document numerous disgraceful betrayals of Israel by the United States, by the Obama administration in connection with Iran. You write at page 274, you say that of all the questions you confronted as ambassador, none was more fateful than what Obama would do regarding Iran. And just to set the stage here, there's no question that Iran is an anti-Semitic terror state. There's no argument that one of its great objects is the elimination of the Jewish state. Would you say that's fair to say?
I think it's more than fair to say, and it's something that I've believed in for many years, and it was the primary, I would say, the nexus between myself and the prime minister. I hadn't been a member of his party or a close associate, but he understood that I understood that Iran posed not one but several existential threats to the state of Israel. I mean, the obvious one, that they're going to get a nuclear weapon, and this is a regime that has pledged almost weekly to wipe Israel off the map. You don't want a country like that to get a nuclear weapon, but Iran is far more than that. Iran is the world's largest state sponsor of terror. Those terrorists are trying to kill us on a daily basis. And if Iran gets the bomb, then the entire Middle East is going to go nuclear, and countries that don't have the most stable governments will have nuclear capabilities within a few years. So it's several existential threats, and it comes down to this. And here, you're right. The administration told us all the years that it wasn't bluffing about a military option. The president recently came out with a statement saying there is no military option. The president says that he has our backs on this issue. Well, to trust somebody to have your back on issues that are vital, not just for your survival, but for your survival of your children and grandchildren, that takes a very deep level of trust. And that is an administration that negotiated for 7 months behind Israel's back with our deadliest enemy and reached an agreement which the vast majority of Israelis, not Benjamin Netanyahu, I'm now a member of Knesset, and I will tell you this is the closest thing Israel has to a national consensus that this is a bad and dangerous deal for the state of Israel. That is why, to put a finer point on this, I'm sitting in Random House, a wonderful publisher that done a beautiful job on my book. They wanted to bring the book out in the fall, and I said, no, it has to come out before the possible signing of the Iranian agreement. The deadline is June 30th, so that we can have this important debate and understand what has occurred over the past 5 years. How did we get to this point, and understand why the people of Israel are so deeply pervasively disturbed by the possibility of signing this accord.
Ambassador Oren, you write that when you first heard the theory that Iran could assist in resolving regional conflicts back in 2008, the idea struck you as absurd.
It is true. I've come back and forth over the years as a visiting professor. In 2008, I was privileged to be at Georgetown, and I first heard a theory that was circling around sort of the think tank, Department of State crowd, that the United States had backed the wrong horses in the Middle East. It had backed the Gulf Sunni states. It had backed Israel. The Sunni states had basically fractured, fallen apart in America's hands. The Israelis created problems with the settlement policy, and that there actually was a strong horse in the Middle East that was stable, sort of democratic, and it was also winning. It was winning in the field, and that state was Iran. And it's America's interest to change its orientation away from Sunnis and Israelis toward Iran. And the first time I heard that, that sounded to me like not just absurd. I was holding back in the book. It sounded to me insane. But I, when I got into the job as ambassador, right from Georgetown, I moved up the street into the embassy. I began to hear it more and more pervasively, and then I began to see elements of it also in policymaking. President Obama has given a number of interviews on the Iranian issue, and he has increasingly said that Iran is a rational country. It operates on a cost-benefit analysis. That Iran, if it enters into a nuclear deal with the United States and the international community, can become a responsible regional power that can actually bring about a reconciliation between Sunnis and Shiites. This goes 100%. In the opposite of Israel's best estimation, and this is of our entire intelligence and military community, and understand this is a fundamental difference between us. But there's even a more basic difference, and I can't stress this enough. It's almost going to sound tautological what I'm going to say, and that is that America is a big country. It's far away from the United States. It's not threatened with national annihilation by Iran, not yet. It has very big military capabilities. We are a small country. We're located in Iran's backyard. We are threatened with national obliteration. We have very respectable military capabilities, but we're not the United States. We don't have aircraft carriers. We don't have strategic bombers. Our margin for error on Iran is exactly zero. Exactly zero. And what at stake is for us is not a legacy. It's not a name. It's the future survival of our country. And to understand that is to understand, I think, my book, understand the timing of the book, and to understand the very, how should we say, robust conversation that the book has already triggered even before its publication.
I hope to get to that, but I wanted to ask you in this context, and you've alluded to it a little bit, President Obama discounts and excuses the anti-Semitic, anti-Israel goals of the Iranian regime. He, what do you make of that? He doesn't take them seriously, or he purports not to take them seriously.
Well, he has said on record that the regime, yes, he has acknowledged that the regime is anti-Semitic, but it is also rational. And has said that you can be anti-Semitic and rational, and rational means that they will not take risks that that would ensure that would endanger the continuation of their power or their ability to achieve their regional goals. And of course, we Jews have an example of very much the opposite. Adolf Hitler and the Nazis, though they desperately needed material and fuel and ammunition to fight. The Allies who were conquering Germany used those precious materials to kill Jews until the last day of World War II. So you can be anti-Semitic and very irrational. And in fact, you can be irrational and take rational steps, like conquering Poland, conquering Czechoslovakia, to reach insane goals. This is what history has taught us. But I think even more fundamentally than that, the question of whether Iran is or is not rational went to the heart of the discussions which Israel held with the United States over the course of at least 5 years over the Iranian issue. Our intelligence estimates very much dovetailed with those of the United States. We saw the same material. We reached the same conclusions. Where the basic difference was, is this regime rational or is it not? President Obama has said that the Iran regime is not North Korea. Prime Minister Netanyahu has said that Iran is worse than 50 North Koreas. Therein lies the difference.
The Supreme Leader doesn't just talk about eliminating Israel. You note in your book the plots to bomb Israeli embassies, including the Washington embassy. And I have to say that even though I follow the news obsessively in this regard, that was news to me. Would you talk a little bit about that?
It's part of it is still classified. You should know this book went through 7 security reviews in the state of Israel, and it was a fascinating process for me. Their perspective on some of the things that I've written, and that particular episode was sensitive. But what I can tell you is that the Iranians operating through proxies, as they often do through drug cartels. And laundering money through used car dealerships around the world. It's a global operation. Plan to assassinate Saudi Arabia's ambassador to Washington in Cafe Milano, a popular Washington bistro, and at the same time to blow up my embassy. And the plot was thwarted. I had to deal with some very heavy security for a while. But what was important, I think, and instructive about the entire episode was that here the Iranians were willing to conduct a major terrorist attack in downtown Washington, D.C. And the plot to kill the Saudi ambassador would have killed maybe hundreds of people. It's a very crowded restaurant. Put a bomb in that restaurant. And we could not identify, I could certainly not identify any price that the Iranians paid. No one said, okay, if you're going to plot a terrorist attack in downtown Washington, D.C., we're not going to negotiate with you. Or the terms of the negotiations are going to change. Or the sanctions are going to be wrapped up. The Saudis, the Iranians were looking at this and drawing conclusions. They are never underestimate the intelligence of the Iranians. They are very intelligent. Former defense minister Ehud Barak used to always say, they don't play checkers, they play chess, and they play multi-tiered chess. And the Iranians, for example, saw what happened to Muammar Gaddafi who gave up his nuclear program and died. They saw what didn't happen to North Korea, which developed more nuclear weapons. Nobody messes with them. They even saw what happened to Bashar al-Assad in Syria. By giving up part of his chemical weapons, he went from being part of the problem to being the solution, and then getting the legitimacy to barrel bomb his own population with impunity. They saw how that worked. And they drew a lot of conclusions. So they drew a conclusion about the fact that they could plot a major terrorist attack in the capital of the United States and not pay a price. And that all went into their triple-tiered chess strategy.
You say a few pages later, Mossad and its foreign intelligence network subsequently managed to thwart similar strikes against Israelis in Kenya, South Africa, Cyprus, Azerbaijan, and Georgia. Can you say anything about that?
Well, Iran is, as I mentioned earlier, is the world's largest state sponsor of terrorism. Outside of Al-Qaeda, Iranian-backed organizations have killed more Americans than any other terrorist organizations in the world. And they also try to kill Israelis around the world. They're operating now in about 35 cities on five continents. They have an international terror network. It's interesting. There are only two countries in the world that divide the planet, the globe, into theaters of operation: the United States, you know, European theater, African theater, and Iran. Iran has theaters of operations, and they operate very extensively in South America and other areas in Africa. So Mossad has been very, very effective in working with partner agencies and thwarting these. You're up against the law of averages, and in Burgas, Bulgaria, a bomber did manage to attack a tourist bus and kill seven Israelis. And this was a great tragedy. So it's not foolproof. We know that the Iranians are actively today, robustly, rigorously, seeking to kill Israelis and Jews around the world.
Ambassador Oren, you wrote a column for the Wall Street Journal that was published on June 15th under the headline, "The Abandonment of Israel," and it summarized one thread of the book. I won't ask you to reiterate it here, but a few days later, the Times of Israel, I think yesterday, reported that the Obama administration was demanding that Prime Minister Netanyahu renounce your column. So far, he's declined. It seems to me that you're getting the treatment that Prime Minister Netanyahu has previously been accorded by the Obama administration. You must be doing something right, but I wonder if you have any thoughts about that, about receiving the same kind of being the subject of the same kind of personal animus that has been directed to Prime Minister Netanyahu by folks whom you including Ambassador Shapiro, whom you describe in the book as your friend.
And I still do. And we've had very strong disagreements in the past, and we have one now as well. Diplomacy, though it often has a reputation for, you know, sort of cocktail parties and soirees and galas, diplomacy is not for the faint of hearted. It is not. It is tough business. It is as tough as you get. And you know, those type of phone calls, and I describe some of them in the book, those 2 a.m., 3 a.m. phone calls with someone screaming you at the other end, you take them seriously, you give them due respect, but you hold your ground. And here, frankly, I have no choice. I feel as a responsible Israeli citizen, I'm an elected official, but I'm a citizen, I'm a father, I'm a grandfather. And I view it not only as my right, but as my unassailable duty to say and write the things I do. Because I reiterate, our margin for error here is zero. This is not about headlines. It's not about book sales. It's about survival. And we live in a tough neighborhood. I'm in a Knesset, you know, Israel's parliament, where last week I was in a discussion about educating young people about transgenderism. Amazing. Hugely attended event. Very moving. But you got to remember that discussion is taking place a two-hour drive from ISIS. Those are our immediate neighbors. There's a distance between where I'm sitting here in New York and Philadelphia. And again, we can't afford to take risks. And we have maybe 2 weeks before this agreement is signed with Iran. It's our right, our duty to say what it means for us, this agreement.
Ambassador Oren, it's Steve Hayward coming in with a final question for you. The book isn't officially out for another 4 or 5 days, although I see this morning it's already designated as a bestseller on Amazon. And of course, it's been getting a lot of... You didn't know that?
No, I didn't.
it's already, of course, generating a lot of publicity. I'm wondering, just from the advanced publicity and some conversations you've already alluded to, private conversations, is there anything in the early reaction that has surprised you, has startled you, pleased you? How's this going? I guess I'll round it off that way.
Well, as I said, diplomacy is not for the faint-hearted, and in Israel too, it has generated a tremendous amount of controversy, and in a way, that was the purpose of the book. The purpose of the book was to get everybody to stop and think, and also think back, because people tend to have very short memories. What happened in 2009, 2010, and you know, this is not ancient history, but it's something sometimes like that. And I want to just attend a hope to this comment. I'm delighted that the book is generating a conversation. That's important. But I hope that the conversation, which is so much focused, say, on the personal relationship between Obama and Netanyahu, would not obscure some of the other discussions that are in the book, which may be directed to a narrow readership. It's talking about Israel's relationship with the American Jewish community, Israel's relationship with the American press, which are also important conversations that the book is trying to animate. But I hope that people will not dismiss it as it has. People have been trying to dismiss it as sort of a political ploy, as an act of imagination. I've basically spent 40 years preparing to write this book, and it comes from the deepest possible place it can come to. I hope people will read it and read it seriously.
Ambassador Oren, thank you so very much for joining us here today. I hope we can have you back in a few months after the dust settles a little bit and talk about some of your other books.
Does it ever settle in the Middle East?
I know. But, you know, I'd love to have you back to talk about your book about the Six-Day War and just broader things, because you've got a lot to offer us. Good luck to you, and thanks very much for joining us.
Everybody, have a great day. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You too. Well, Scott and Paul, that was fascinating. And the ambassador's very busy, so he can only give us about 20 minutes of his time. And I think there's a lot more to say about this. You know, I haven't read the book, and I've only read a little of the publicity. But, boy, why do I keep getting the feeling that we're at another Munich moment where we are about to dismember or betray an ally in the naive thought that we can buy off a tyrannical regime. I'm simply astounded at where we are. And the ambassador was very diplomatic, as he needs to be, but still very forceful. Scott?
This is the question that I struggle with, having read the book, is he's not a Likudnik. If you situated him on the American political spectrum, which is a line of questions I wanted to do, but edited out in the interests of time, of the time that he gave to us, I think he'd be an independent. I think he fell for Obama in 2008. So he's not, he really, people who know him and his work know he can't be discounted as a right-wing nut. And on the question of Iran, the whole line that he describes in 2008 as having heard at cocktail parties with elite academics in Georgetown is the reigning doctrine that we have been living under for the past 6.5 years, and that he describes in the book when he first heard about it as absurd. It's absurd. It was absurd in 2008. It's absurd in 2015. There's the facts belie it. That Iran can be talked out of its large goals that include the elimination of Israel. There's a lot of evidence to support the taking those goals very seriously. I was afraid I'd missed some of the news regarding these plots against Israeli embassies around the world, but it sounds like some of that information was classified. I'd only picked up that we'd apprehended the plot against the Saudi Arabian embassy in D.C., but it sounds like from his book that there was also a planned attack on the Israeli embassy. Why not throw that in as well in D.C.? And several other Israeli embassies around the world. I don't think, Steve, is there a plausible case that Iran, from the standpoint of the United States, can be a constructive force in the Middle East? I don't think there is, and he doesn't draw the conclusion from that, and we all shrink from it. But what do you make of that, Paul Mehrenkopf? What do you make of that? Where are you on this?
Oh, it's ridiculous. Iran could be a force Only regime change could make Iran a constructive force in the Middle East. I agree with him that the Iranians are really smart, but they miscalculated when they thought about bombing Cafe Milano, because that's where all the Washington elites hang out. And it would have been a terrible mistake. They should have plotted to kill the Saudi ambassador somewhere else besides Cafe Milano, because at Cafe Milano, they probably would have taken out a dozen or so Obama-nicks. But seriously, this is preposterous. And I was struck by the connection that the ambassador has drawn, I believe, in the book, but certainly in other interviews, that he sees the source of President Obama's stance towards Israel, which he says is not hostile, as stemming from his views about America, as set forth in Dreams from My Father. Scott, maybe you can comment on this, because you're the one who studied the book, but he seems to feel that the main source of Obama's views on Israel and presumably Iran is his view about America. That's something we've argued on Powerline, but I'm surprised to hear it being argued, by an ambassador or a former ambassador.
Well, he read Dreams from My Father carefully, and I would say, he notes the absence of any love of America in the book, and maybe even more so with respect to America than with respect to Israel. But we have, where does that leave us with respect to Obama and America? I mean, we have the same questions about what he's up to with the United States, how subversive he is of what we think of as the United States. And I think this book leaves me hanging on that question, as well as the question of Israel. I find it deeply troubling, and I really can't say more about it.
I'm concerned about where it goes from here. I mean, obviously, the deal with Iran is going to be disastrous, and that will be Obama's legacy. But I'm concerned about, Obama, he'll do his damage, and then he'll be gone. I'm concerned about what it means, though, for Israel and Israel's relationship with the Democratic Party going forward, because Israel's always depended on, bipartisan support. If Israel becomes the country favored by the Republicans but not the Democrats, that's big trouble. And Ambassador Oren has said some nice things about Hillary Clinton,
right?
Whether he's sincere or not,
right. He does so in the book.
Is anybody's guess, but I think that's the number two legacy. The number one legacy is the Iran deal, which is destructive enough. The number two legacy is this possible wedge between the Democrats and Israel, which is also ideologically driven, because it's that same ambivalence towards America, which is pushing. Which pushed Obama away from Israel, certainly exists in large precincts of the Democratic Party.
Yeah, Paul, you raise, I think, a really important point that I think I want to expand on a little bit, and that I picked up from Ambassador Oren. You leave aside the Iran agreement for a moment. It might not happen. It may yet collapse. And also, we are going to be getting rid of Obama here in 18 months or so with a new president, hopefully a better one. But I was quite intrigued with him talking about how some of the problems that he talks about predate Obama, right? You're starting to hear in 2008 people in the foreign policy and State Department establishment entertaining these fantasies about how, Iran can be a reasonable partner. The implication here, and sometimes it's not just implied but explicit, is that Israel is the obstacle to peace with the Palestinians. And that looks to be deeply embedded now amongst some of our foreign policy elites and our bureaucracy. So that even a good president, we may have to contend with that. You saw little hints of, a bit of that under Secretary of State James Baker back under the first President Bush. And I don't know, here's what I connected to. One of the things about Powerline that we don't really ever talk about or write about much is, we have kind of this interfaith website, right? You two guys are Jewish. John and I are Protestant evangelical Christians of some kind. What I think is going on anti-Semitism is becoming legitimized again. You certainly see it overtly in Europe. And, you know, it used to be, you know, anti-Semitism used to be perfectly acceptable in the United States before World War II. And I think that is slowly creeping back the way it has in Europe, in our own State Department and amongst our elites. And I think this is quite insidious. And that's it. That's the end of my comment.
Ambassador Arnn has also, though, has also been somewhat dismayed by the American Jewish community. So there's that dimension, too. But in support of what you say, Steve, before 2008, when Iran became the, you know, the country of choice for solving all of our woes in the Middle East, before that, it was Syria. Recall, you know, in 2007, 2006, this was the Nancy Pelosi and John Kerry grand dream that Syria would solve all our problems. And when that wasn't panning out, it became Iran. So there, it's not really based on any substantive view of what these countries stand for. It's based on an ideological drive to find someone, some anti-Israeli state that can solve all our woes in the Middle East, broker a Palestinian deal, end terrorism. And the very irrationality of it is manifest because, you know, it jumps from one implausible country to another.
Yeah, well, I think I think we should probably wrap up the show on this one topic, and unless you have some last comments for us, Scott. But I think all of our listeners and readers should go out and get Ambassador Arnn's book, right?
It's a mind-boggling book, and I just highly recommend it for anyone trying to understand the, as I said, the long, strange trip we've been on and are still going to be on for the next 19 months.
Right. Well, thank you, Scott. Thank you, Paul. A special thanks again to Ambassador Arnn. That's the Power Line show for this week. We're going to be picking up the frequency of our shows here. We've got some other great guests booked ahead, and we're also going to take Scott Johnson's papers away from him, so he's not doing his low-rent Rush Limbaugh imitation there in the background. But bye, everybody. Until next time.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com. Join the conversation.